Good evening. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. It's April 8th, 2010. You're on the Soleri Report. I'm delighted you could join us this evening. Tonight, what a week. Our theme for the week is $140 billion for a job well done. The lead story is the Wall Street Journal reported that Wall Street in 2009 was paid $140 billion in bonuses, which is the largest record year of compensation for Wall Street ever. I just want to let that sink in because the reason I say for a job well done, the people who run this country and who run investment capital on the planet don't pay for poor behavior. And if there was ever proof positive that Wall Street ran literally a pump and dump, and made as much money on the dump, if not more, as the pump, it's the fact that they got paid record compensation again for a job well done. I said in my year-end wrap-up at the beginning of the year that the single best investment of 2009 was the money spent to get Obama elected president, that he had bailed Wall Street, or had provided $12 trillion of bailouts to Wall Street, both through the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, but really his political capital. And I thought I'd just do a couple of calculations and look at that $140 billion to give you a sense of how much it is. $140 billion works out to 1.16% of $12 trillion. And if you look at typical fees paid for asset management and money management, particularly in the high-risk area, you know, when you think about it, $140 billion is not inappropriate according to market rates. Another way to look at $140 billion is last year Tennessee had 1 million people on food stamps and spent $1 billion of money to fund that program. This week also announced was that 38, 39 million are now in the United States are now on food stamps, a record for the number of people on food stamps, and defying the description of what that we're in a recovery and what a recovery might be. But if we just multiply out and say, okay, if Tennessee spent $1 billion for 1 million people, let's just assume and round off for purposes of discussion that we spend, or we're going to spend $50 billion to have 39 billion people on food stamp. What we're saying is we gave three times that amount of money to Wall Street for bonuses. Now, the thing that is extraordinary and really an indication of where we are is that the media was not afraid to say this coming into the very week when everybody in America is preparing their taxes. And it's not surprising that the King Report reported that the number of people not paying taxes, not paying federal taxes, is at a record. Now, I can hear Franklin on the phone, so I'm gonna ask him to join me this week during Money and Markets because there's so much going on that weaves into the precious metals market. But, Franklin, I just also wanted you to know, because you may have a comment on this, that $140 billion, apparently the top 25 hedge fund managers made $1 billion each plus. And I just want to underscore that it goes to show how much money you can make when you can borrow from the central banking system at 0% and lend back to the Treasury at 4 to 6% and leverage.
You must have heard me giggling. That's
how you
did.
I heard you giggling.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, that's 50 million people versus 300 people. That's pretty well in order. I mean, you know, that's a pretty good ratio, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if you ever read Martin Armstrong, but Martin Armstrong had a very interesting piece that he just published where he describes someone from Capitol Hill writing him and saying how depressed it feels up on Capitol Hill because everybody who warned about, you know, what could happen with the bubble and the meltdown turned out to be right, and everybody's ignoring them. And the guys who didn't predict it, didn't prepare for it, and, you know, basically gave away the store in the middle of it are being held up and lifted up. And I wanted to write to him and say, well, maybe you're just describing that things are really, you know, you're describing how things really are, and the guys who pulled off the pump and dump are being rewarded, and the guys who tried to stop it are being ignored.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's our theme for the week, $140 billion for a job well done. But I like to think that the first and most important thing we need to navigate this environment is a good map, and I think, you know, the beauty in this $140 billion, it's an expensive lesson, but it allows you to see very clearly how the system really works.
Could I add there? This is the problem that people cannot get over. I've noticed a few roadblocks in dealing with people, and this is one of the greatest. They just can't believe that the system really does work for the larcenous. It really does reward the fraud.
Uh-huh.
And they have been so ingrained with this idea of the rule of law and the fundamental justice of American society and American politics that they just cannot digest this fact that they have no conceptual pigeonhole to put into. You know, it won't fit anywhere they try to put it. And the fact is that the entire system, Catherine, is set up to reward predators and parasites.
Right.
It's not set up to reward all you nice, hardworking folks out there who, you know, get up at 6:15 and smack off your alarm and go get dressed and rush down to work so that you can serve other people. It's the exact opposite.
Right.
And until you understand that, you will continue to be victimized by the entire system.
Right. Well, I wanted to mention my hero this week, and it's one of the reasons I wanted Franklin to join me early. My hero of the week, I came over on Saturday to go to a wonderful Great Hall service at Franklin's Church, Christ Our Hope, here in West Point, Tennessee. And this is a church that I watched the Sanders family build, and it's a little bit, I Franklin and his family left Memphis in the late 90s and came out to sort of rural Tennessee and literally taught themselves how to be farmers. And, you know, it's some pretty funny stories and all of that. But now Top of the World Farm is growing, and, you know, they've got a real farm, and they even know how to farm. And so they're just getting their arms around, you know, they're running a precious metals dealership, they're running the Money Changer newsletter, they're doing all sorts of special projects, and they're getting their arms around learning to farm. And Franklin announces they're going to build a church, and I thought, you know, these guys are taking on more than they can chew. And I watched them build this church. Anyway, so we had the Easter service on Sunday that was absolutely beautiful. Justin Sanders, Franklin's wonderful son, who really played a leading role in the construction. And you walked around that church, Franklin, and it, first of all, it's one of the most beautiful churches I've ever been in, and it's certainly the most beautiful that costs less than $10 million. And you walk around the church and you think, the people who built this were real pros. They knew exactly what they were doing. They probably did this hundreds of times before. But when you realize these are people who taught themselves how to build something. I asked Franklin and Susan tonight, I said, did you guys know how to build a house 10 years ago? And they thought that was the funniest thing in the world. They said, we were city folks. But the reason I wanted to talk about Justin as the hero for the week is once you get into your head that the current system you're in is something you don't want to be a part of, and the future is the one you're going to build, and you say, okay, I'm going to figure out how to learn how to, you know, whatever it is. I'm not saying that you take Franklin's pathway or my pathway, but whatever that pathway is, the future that I want is the one I'm going to build, and I can build it because I'm just going to have to figure out how to build it. One of my favorite quotes is from Winston Churchill, who says, we did not travel all the way across the centuries, across the prairies, across the mountains, because we are made of sugar cane. But what is astonishing to me, as I was watching the church come up, and the pew, did you find the pews through eBay?
It actually cost more to get the pews shipped to us than it did to buy them. There's a website called, believe it or not, something like Used Church Furniture is Up or something like that. And so we got all those oak pews for next to nothing. I think maybe we paid $3,000. It cost $4,000 to get them shipped or something like that.
Okay. Well, if you go to our blog under Life, there's a a link to Chrysler. You know, do you have any pictures up on the blog? On the
yes, there's supposed to be pictures up now.
Okay, yeah. So, but you certainly want to try to come to service. But it's proof positive that if you just burn your boats and start, it's amazing what you can get accomplished in 10 years.
I want to tell you a funny story about the church, though, about money, because all of us believe that money is the ruling factor in life, and this is just proof that it's not. When we determined that we were going to build a church that was both beautiful and functional, and so we settled on these cypress log construction. Susan has a brother who's an architect. She took the plans over to him in Memphis, and he looked at it and he said, "Well, you can't build this for under $500,000." And she said, "Well, I'm sorry, but we don't have but $250,000, so we're going to have to do it for that." We got now it wasn't completely finished, but we got it up and habitable for $220,000.
Wow.
And, you know, part of that's being out in the country where you don't have all those restrictive zoning and construction laws and so forth, although it's a completely safe building. I mean, you know that. You've
right.
seen it. There are no safety issues there. But anyway, it's just amazing if you just say, well, we're going to do it, and you just go ahead and do it and meet all those obstacles and say, well, there's a way around this, it works out.
Yeah, part of it is when you say, we're leaving. we're withdrawing, we're leaving. And well, another thing I wanted to mention, because I took the article I wrote called Gifting to the Children You Love, which was really inspired by so many clients and subscribers and friends who were grappling with issues related to, how are we going to build local economies and how are we going to build a better world? And I said, you know, if you don't start investing in your children and the grandchildren and the children around you, you know, that's our future. And the biggest competition right now in the economy is who's going to get our kids. Are our kids going to, you know, go to Harvard and go to work on Wall Street and never come back? Or are kids going to stay and build the local economy? And so I encourage you to take a look at that, gifting to the children you love. But do not leave children out of the equation of the future you're building, because they're the ones who are going to, you know, they're going to the ones who are going to take it the distance. So let me continue on money and markets. Continued fears about sovereign debt from Greece to the municipalities. We saw the rating on Los Angeles dropped, and more talk about concerns about the municipal bond market as we get closer to the June 30 date, more layoffs from municipalities. On the international front, we saw more sort of coverage over the nuclear deal made between the Russians and the United States. I think it's very important to underscore, as you read criticism that Obama is giving away our national security, that in fact our national security is increasingly dependent on weaponry and intelligence other than nuclear bombs, and maintaining that arsenal is very expensive for both Russia and the United States, and when whatever downsizing goes on, we'll still have enough nuclear power to outpower everybody by enormous multiples. So what the president and the national security state can't tell you is what all the new fancy weaponry is, but I assure you that it's there. We saw the IRS announce a program targeting wealthy individuals globally. It's almost the equivalent, it's the IRS equivalent of the big banks announcing, you know, private offices for wealthy individuals where they're going to concentrate on serving wealthy individuals worldwide. It sent a chill through many, many sort of independent entrepreneurs and private people who still exist outside the tapeworm. It's an ominous sign, as are the continued issuance of regulations. I wanted to report on the HIRE Act this week, and what I did was I put up a number of significant summaries of the HIRE Act provisions related to, in effect, backdoor capital controls. What we're watching is the foreign banks being asked by 2013 to literally become an enforcement arm of the IRS, and if they don't, to face draconian withholding provisions on their U.S. investments. The terms and provisions are very confusing, so I hope to have finally that for next week. But the summaries are up on the blog. We've also seen the IRS announce regulations for the foreign financial accounts, the FBAR regulations. That's also up on the blog. The combination of the IRS program, the feedback we're getting of more IRS audits, the HIRE Act provisions, the FBAR regulations, all of this combines to just be more of the backdoor capitals that we've been talking about. In that vein, I wanted to touch base on the census, which is something I've talked about the last several Solari reports. We got a number of reports that different websites and different TV programs were saying that the fine, which in the statute for not responding to the census, is $100. Congress passed a statute saying you can be fined $100 for not complying. We were getting reports that Fox News, Yahoo Finance, a variety of other people were either reporting that the fine was up to $100 per question or up to $5,000. And we published this week, we took the time out, sat down, and published a very extensive report on what basis the census would describe their right to fine up to $5,000. It's up on the blog, and I won't go through all of it. It's more than you would ever want to know. The reality is that my position is the fine's $100. I think if the census, the Bureau of the Census tries to fine more than $100, they're going to run into a real firestorm. There are serious legal questions as to whether they have the authority to do it. They haven't promulgated regs. They haven't described an enforcement process. If you look at their website, they're saying that the fine is for not complying to the American Community Service survey, which is different than the 10-year census. And if you look at how the fine is being described, it's lumping the two together in a way which I would describe as a terrorist tactic. So I take the position that the chances of fining $5,000 are, it's a theoretical possibility. As a practical matter, I don't believe it. We have yet to be able to find one example of prosecution or fining related to a refusal to comply with the census. In 2000, the compliance rate was 72%. 28% of those surveyed did not comply, did not respond. In fact, if you look at who's not paying taxes, it's a significantly higher percentage. Now, the reason and if you're concerned about the issue of whether you respond to the census, I really encourage you to go read our report. It's called a Solari Report, Census Fines. The reason I bring this up is that several people who I have enormous respect for, very capable, very intelligent, said to me this week, and they're all precious metals owners, and people who in the past have expressed concern that their gold might be confiscated, and they said to me that they had in fact filled out the census form, and because the questions were innocuous, at which point I almost fell off my chair. In fact, I told Franklin tonight at dinner about it. Did you fall off your chair, Franklin?
Just about. No.
Well, I kept really, the thing that stunned me was that they said the data was innocuous. So I just want to describe this again, not to beat a dead horse, but when you fill out the 10-year census, which is a 10-question form, you can see the questions up on the blog reports, what you're doing is you're turning over detailed and precise geographic location about where you are, who lives with you, and presumably where your assets are. And you're turning it over to a group of defense contractors, including a defense contractor who, and this is all documented, very well documented and published, ran the databases to support the Holocaust for the Nazis. So what that does is that gives them a very precise location to connect and aggregate with all the data that they have and can get on you, which I assure you is enormous. And you've just made their databases infinitely more powerful in terms of quickly operationalizing something. And what I said in the article is that the data and digital controls related to the U.S. population is compounding at a faster rate than the interest on the national debt. And, in fact, there's a connection between the two of them because, in fact, it's you and your earnings power, the taxes you pay, and your assets which serve as collateral for the U.S. debt. And so the last thing any of us want is a highly precise, highly accurate database that will help them manage the relationship between those two. Enough said. You decide. But all the details are up on the blog as to why I say hooey. The fine is $100. I'm not saying they might not make an example of a few people. It's much more likely to be me than you. But it's hooey, I think, that it's $5,000. One thing I will say, if you look at the precedent on what they've done, what they're saying is under the Sentencing Act, which I believe of 1979, they reserve the right to fine any infraction for which Congress has legislated a fee, even if that fine is only $2 or $100, they reserve the right to fine up to $5,000. So you may want to consider not using the national parks anymore because the same precedent could literally apply to any infraction involving federal jurisdiction. So the census, increased capital controls, the IRS. We've also seen reverberation from the CFTC hearings. At the CFTC hearings, there was a fair amount of testimony confirming that the London market is highly leveraged to 101. If everybody asked for their gold or asked to settle in gold, they clearly couldn't do it. This is not new news to many people in the markets. You haven't seen a lot of reaction in terms of the impact on the price or there's some concern among people in the know. What is happening is in the precious metals market, the same dawning and realization is happening that's happening in the mortgage markets, that's happening in the treasury markets, that's happening in the stock market with naked short selling, and that is it's slowly dawning on people that the nature of the collateral fraud is so extraordinary that literally the financial system has become a governance matrix. You know, it's almost a video game, and there really is no grounding of the paper in the real world. So if you look at the stock market and what's happening with naked short selling, you know, if I own a stock, you know, if and everybody who owns a stock gets together and adds it up, it's probably many more people and many more shares than the company thinks exists. I've talked about the collateral fraud in the mortgage market, the treasury market, same story. Same story in the precious metals market. And so there's a slow dawning, but what has not yet quite connected is the people focused on the short in one market connecting the dots with the other markets. It's going to be very interesting to see when and how that happens. I didn't know if you wanted to comment on this one, Franklin.
Well, you left out one of the major players, and that's the government that acts as a backstop for all of these market manipulations. For example, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which manipulates the dollar or tries to manipulate the dollar market, the gold and silver markets. Then you've got the Plunge Protection Team that literally manipulates the stock market price. So we're at a point where you can't trust market prices anymore. You don't know
right.
if they're vastly higher or vastly lower than they ought to be. I think in the case of stocks, they're vastly higher than they ought to be. I mean, if you look at the at the stage that we are in the decline in the stock market, which really began in 2000, and you still got a 20-to-1 PE price earnings ratio, that's ridiculous. I mean, the bottom of a market is when the PE goes to 6, and none of this makes any sense. You look at it and you say, well, how is that possible? How can this be a natural development? Guess what the answer is? It's not a natural development.
I remember
it's had fertilizer.
Right. I remember in the late 90s, because I think this is a transition that all of us are going through. Mm. I decided I was going to drive around the country and try and understand what was going on in the real economy. And it took many years, but I finally realized I'm going to start functioning. One, I'm going to leave the system behind. I'm going to go build the future. And two, I'm going to do it according to long-term fundamental economics as I'm reading it from the real economy. I'm just going to ignore the paper.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to ignore it. Now, I pay attention to it since I've become an investment advisor. I pay attention to it, but I don't want to get tricked into it. But it's really, you know, it's a whole shift in paradigm to walk away and say, you know, this thing is a matrix. And if you look at the collateral fraud across the board, it's, you know, you're basically completely dependent on the ability of a small handful of players to kill with impunity. And that's not enough to make a system go over the long run, and I'm not comfortable here.
It's certainly not enough to make the system go over the long run when at any point you can have a stampede in the opposite direction that overwhelms the ability of the system to manage the markets at the margin. And,
right.
And that's what you're always dealing with because, you know, they're just like cowboys riding around on the edge of a herd, and they're trying to get to urge the herd on the margins. They're trying to urge the herd to go in one direction. If the herd decides it doesn't want to go in that direction, guess what's going to happen?
Right.
The cowboys are going to get knocked off their horses.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons they want much more invasive digital control and systems.
Oh, yeah, because they – you know, that gives them the ability to control the system even more completely than they already do.
Well, but the more leverage the system is, the more tight control you need.
Sure.
Because the system doesn't have the resiliency to be not tightly controlled.
Well, the leverage sucks away all its resiliency.
Right.
When you've got 100-to-1 leverage, you don't have any resilience.
You
can't dodge anywhere. you're stuck.
Everybody needs to do what they're told. Well, I, you know, one of the things we were talking about during dinner was the moment that you come to when you decide, you know, I'm not going along with this. I'm not doing this. And one of the things I've seen coming back to me in the discussion on the census or other issues related, you know, Schumer has now proposed a bill that would have a biometric national ID. And apparently you couldn't, according to the Campaign for Liberty has now sent out petitions to sign. I signed and sent one back to my congressman and senator today, but essentially you wouldn't be able to work without your biometric national ID card. And India this week announced they're implementing a national biometric ID.
I'd hate to try to control a billion Indians to do anything. That's crazy.
But I want to remind everybody, we've seen the swine flu vaccination program just get completely backed up because people said no. And the people who had to implement said no. The healthcare practitioners said no. We're not taking the vaccine and we're not giving it to other people. No. And the person who pointed out to me, you know, Franklin, the real precedent that came long before that was homeschooling. People mm-hmm. said no. You're not going to teach my children, you know, that way. No. And it just goes to show you the line is going to get drawn where you have a critical mass of people who just say no. And what was it you said tonight? Freedom equals no.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Right.
Well, there's a great science fiction story in which these, you know, the thesis is that mankind has burst out of the bonds of Earth and gone to all these different planets. And so the central authority is trying to reassert its authority. And they land on this planet and there's a, the main character's name is Zeke, and he's driving his bicycle to go see his friend. And these people from Earth arrest him, and they say, "Well, you've got to do this, you've got to do that." And he just looks at him and says, "No, I won't." And every time they take their hands off of him, he starts heading off in the same direction he was going in the first place. Well, you know, that's it. Freedom is the ability to say no.
Right.
And if you just say no, it's extremely powerful. And I'd like to go back to that critical mass thing that you said. What a lot of homeschoolers even don't understand is that there were a very few people in the beginning, and I'm talking about in the early 70s, who said, "You can send me to jail, but I'm going to teach my children at home." And there were maybe, you know, less than 100 of them that did that, but they cut the way for the rest of us.
Right.
And that was the critical mass. It was a tiny number of people. And they just overwhelmed the state's willingness to put them all in jail.
Well, one of the things I'm looking forward to about this year is if you look at all the news this week, you know, whether it's the IRS, what they're announcing, or the audits that are growing and being reported, or the, you know, if you look at the capital controls sort of that popped out in the HIRE Act without a whole lot of discussion, it's a little bit of a surprise, or you look at the, you know, it goes on and on and on, or the national biometric ID. I mean, what I'm seeing is people looking at this and saying, these people are nuts. And the hardest thing I've had to do for the last 10 years, you know, in Hickory Valley or in my life, is to try and explain to normal, healthy, busy, hardworking people how nuts the plans are. You know, I mean, these people believe in slavery. They practice slavery. They believe in it. You know, you try and warn people, and everyone's like, no, it can't possibly be. And one of the reasons, I'll skip ahead and do the movie before we start the Precious Metals Report. I put up a wonderful little BBC made for TV movie called The Last Days of Lehman. And Lehman to date is still the largest bankruptcy. And it tells the story of Lehman having liquidity problems, of course, having a mortgage portfolio that's more melting down, and Lehman thinking it's going to get a bailout and not getting it at the last minute, and sort of the personalities, and the implication being that the West is in real trouble and it's melting down and these guys are doing the best that they could, or it's beyond them. You sort of get the sense of a whole bunch of sort of hardworking, greedy guys, powerful guys, and they kind of don't know what they're doing, but they do know what they're doing, but they don't know what they're doing. And you don't get the sense of people who are paid $140 billion to pull off a pump and dump. But what it does do is it gives you a look at the personalities. Unfortunately, it affirms the idea. We saw wonderful author Michael Lewis, who wrote Liar's Poker, has got a new book out that I'm got sitting in my den, and I'm going to read it, on the people who shorted the housing market and sort of helped facilitate the meltdown. And I saw a clip of Michael Lewis on television basically explaining that this thing got away from people, and they didn't know, you know, it kind of all got away from them because they really didn't understand what was going on, which is the biggest bunch of hooey I've ever heard in my life.
Sure.
And so when you watch a very entertaining The Last Days of Lehman, it really does take you in and give you a feeling and flavor of Wall Street and sort of the personalities. Just remember that at the end of the day, you're being sold a big lie. Because, in fact, there are people who know what's going on, and this whole thing, as many of us have documented, was not an accident. Okay, Precious Metals Market Report. We're going to handle the questions for Ask Catherine in the Precious Metals Market Report. We've had quite a week in precious metals, Franklin. Why don't you update us?
Well, the both gold and silver went up and broke out of either trading ranges or formations that they had been in. The gold and silver proved that it had been, after going down to 1085, proved that it had been creating or tracing out on the chart an upside-down head and shoulders formation. And, of course, that's a bottoming formation. It did that. The implication of that formation, I mean, there's a measuring device that you use. You look at the bottom of the head, you measure to the neckline, and you take that number of points and add that to where the breakout is, and that tells you what the target is. So it's got a target of about 1,250 points. It confirmed yesterday that, sure enough, it had broken out because it made a great gain, went up to 1,150. So now what we're doing is we're waiting for gold to add another confirmation of that by going over the roughly 1160 high that it made in January, and once it does that, then we're back into rally mode. I mean, nobody can argue that we're back into rally mode. Silver has a little different configuration, but it's in the same state in the sense that it's broken out over the downtrend line from last December. And so, you know, when a market does that, it's always going to move a lot I say it's always going to move. It ought to move a lot higher. It normally will move a lot higher than it had been. So with the silver, what we're looking at is 1950, which was the last high, and then before that, the 2008 high of 2045. And if silver gets above that, then it's Katie bar the door. But it will get above that point, Catherine. That's the question is, will it get above that point soon? We've got a seasonal pattern that goes on in the gold and silver markets, and that seasonal pattern calls for a high sometime in late May or in the month of May. Highs in the spring are very, very common. Then you get a low toward the end of June, 1st of July. Sometimes it stretches out to the end of July. And then the market starts rising again in August, and usually you get a high October, November, December. Well, where we are right now is that it is possible for gold to make a new high between now and the end of May. And if that's the case, and silver performs the way it normally does, which is that it moves up faster in the second leg of an up market than it does in the first, that is, it outperforms gold in that second leg, then we could see the gold-silver ratio go down to 47.5 and give us an opportunity to swap silver for gold. We could see some really active things. If that doesn't happen, if we just go sideways in a kind of frustrating sideways market for a while, then we'll wait until August, and then that's when gold and silver will start rising again. But for right now, everything's on target. The low was seen at 1050 back in January in gold and at 1680 or 1660 in silver. And we're right on target. I mean, it's everything's fine.
This week, you saw the dollar go up. You saw oil go up. You saw stocks go up. You saw precious metals go up. It was like somebody blew a whistle and said, let's get out of bonds. I mean, what was that about?
Well, I think, you know, the problem with the bonds is that they depend on the value of the dollar. And all of a sudden, if you get people, if you get enough people thinking, well, the dollar's gone as far as it's going to go, it's time to get out of the dollar and go into something else. There's a lot of loose money out there in hedge funds and so forth. And when I say loose money, I mean big loose money. And when it sloshes into a small market like gold or silver, it can have a huge effect. Stocks and bonds are much, much bigger than...
Well, think about it. If you can borrow at 0 to 1%, you know, it doesn't hurt to try things.
Oh, goodness. No. Yeah. What kind of mistake can you make? But I think one thing that you really have to be careful about here to point out is that the stocks have pretty much run their course. They've shot their wad, and you may have seen the high this week. It may go, the Dow may go back to, it may touch 11,000 or 11,100, but the top is pretty well in. The indicators that I look at, like MACD, Moving Average, Convergence, Divergence, and Relative Strength Index, are just at nosebleed levels. They can't continue to stay there. This is unquestionably a rally in an ongoing bear market, and so it just can't last much longer. And when it does go down, it's going to go down really, really hard, because all these people are kidding themselves that there's an economic recovery going on, and they see these indices pop up a point or 2 points, and they think, oh well, that's it, it's all over. It's not all over.
Well, I wanted to point out some of what's carrying the market up.
Mm-hmm.
We have wonderful articles, Sunday Bloody Sunday is up on the blog, on healthcare reform. From March 26, 2009 to March 26, 2010, so 1 year ending March 26, the S&P 500, Franklin, was up 40%.
Mm-hmm.
Aetna was up 40%. Cigna was up 92%. United Health was up 51%. WellPoint was up 73%. And Humana was up 88%.
Does that tell you who the healthcare quote reform is for?
Right. Now, the one that caught my eye the best, the Wall Street Journal had a wrap-up of best performing funds in all categories for 1 year ending in the first quarter. And I picked it up, and I was stunned, and I know we're coming off the lows. The number one best performing sector was financial services, and the number two best performing sector was real estate. And again, if you're financing your position with 0%, I mean, why not?
Or better yet, the government's just giving you free money. So.
Well, I am concerned that we could see, I don't think it's a big chance because I'm a believer in the slow burn, but I do think there's a reasonable chance of another 2008 meltdown or swoon in asset values across the board. And, and that does concern me. And I think it's part of living, it's what I've said before, it's part of living with the volatility we're just going to have to live with.
Right.
That's the way it is.
But that, you know, that people need to, serious investors need to keep that in mind, that is a possibility. And one of the reasons they need to keep it in mind is because when it happens, the shakeout is so severe that it makes you doubt whether your long-term perspective is correct or not.
Right.
And I think last time we saw, silver go down to 880, gold go down to 705, everything looked like the end of the world. Stock market was dropping too, dollar was rising, and it looked like, well, we were all wrong. Well, we weren't all wrong. And the ensuing 12 months richly proved that we were not wrong, because all that loss was gained back and added to.
Right.
So you have to be aware that these shakeouts are going to come, and so you have to steel your soul for it. I have no other way to say
there's
it.
I said this to a subscriber this week. There's a game in Afghanistan. It's there's a depiction of it in a wonderful movie called The Horseman by Omar Sharif.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Bushkaji, and it's the precursor of polo. Two teams on horses play for the body of a dead lamb. It's
mm-hmm.
also in Rambo 3. There's a Sylvester Stallone plays in the Bushkaji. And a team of riders try and protect their rider who's got the body of the dead lamb, is trying to take it over the goalpost. The other team, everybody carries whips. The other team tries to get that rider to drop it and by whipping. So everybody, and the rules are there are no rules. Okay. So, and this week in the precious metals markets, if you look at the various spin trying to scare people into doing this or that against their better interests, it was literally like a financial bushkaji.
Mm-hmm.
because there were no rules. And the question is, can we terrorize people into forgetting what they're doing and why they're doing it to get them to do what, you know, whatever that thing is? And one of them related to this report by Zero Hedge that there were problems related to, there was a what I would say is a very thin report on King World News that Scotiabank was not a trustworthy depository, and they told a story by the head of Central Fund. Central Bank does not use Scotiabank for its gold, and the next thing you know, Zero Hedge is writing in our, well, everybody calls me, say, whoa, 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 whoa.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, but you see this fear and distrust and a breakdown of trust, because in a market where the leverage is 100 to 1, even though they say they have your gold, and the unallocated pools really don't have a 1 to 1 collateral. What, you know, what is happening is the wars and the fear are going up and up and up. And of course, last week we launched Solari Silver and Gold in partnership with you. Thank you
mm-hmm.
very much. But I was sitting here in your offices about 6 months ago, and I forget what it was you said. But I said, I looked at you, and I said, you know, because for many years I considered starting a fund doing securities.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at you, and I said, you know, I'm going to have to start a precious metals dealership, because I want people to buy real things. And so I've got to align my business. I don't want them having all their money in brokerage accounts. They're going to need to buy and own and control the gold themselves. And so I've got to get in alignment with that. And so I guess I'm not going to start a fund. I guess I'm going to start a precious
Well, you know, somebody wrote me this week and with that report, you know, and he said, comment on this. What do you think about this? And I really don't have a comment, because I've been saying all along, don't trust any depository. And I'm not saying that I think that this story is true. I don't have any idea whether it's true or not.
Right.
I just mean that none of these people, none of them are reliable. None of the only one I have any trust in at all is James Turk's gold money, and the rest of them I have no trust in. So that's why I've told people.
I have trust for others. I mean, I certainly have trust for James and his operation, and I have trust. There's some others I have trust for.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is when you have a business that is responsible to protect other people's assets, and you're dealing with a governance structure which does not obey the law and will use violence to impose its will, and you're dealing with private parties who can kill with impunity, how do you maintain institutional relationships? Because the only thing that has integrity is that which you can enforce. And this was my experience at Hamilton. I was able to protect the integrity of our transactions, but I had to risk my life.
Mm.
You know, and so in that circumstance, you certainly want to have something that you can, you know, you know where it is, but nobody else does.
And it's portable.
And it's portable. Mm. Especially if you gave the Census Bureau precise location where you are. One of the things we did when we launched Solari Silver and Gold we decided that we would only sell initially to subscribers. And part of that was I have found with people who are new to precious metals,
mm-hmm.
that there's tremendous advantage to having an ongoing relationship and having a library of wonderful, you know, more than a year of precious metals reports with frequently asked questions and all sorts of information so that they have a continuing relationship to support them in their ownership.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for sophisticated buyers, they don't need that, or people who are experienced at it. But for many buyers, and I think we're coming into a period, Franklin, when the number of new coin owners is going to skyrocket.
Oh,
And you know, and that's part of why we're doing it. But I want those folks to have access to ongoing support, and I feel a lot more comfortable, particularly coming from the securities market and a believer in a lot of the good securities regulation about the importance of ongoing disclosure and support. One of the questions we got was, do you foresee opening it up to non-subscribers? In theory, yes. But I'd like to try a model where there's ongoing support for them. And, you know, part of it is every month we do this precious metals report, and I think it's wonderful support, and there's way for people to ask questions, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you know, I go back in my mind to a comment you made to me a number of years ago that we've entered an era when we have to trust other people with our lives. The people that we do business with have to be those that we can trust with our lives. If I give you my word and I say I'm going to do XYZ, you have to know that I'm going to do it because I don't have any legal way to enforce it.
Right.
I mean, as a practical matter, the courts are no good. And if I have to go...
And who would want to involve them in our business?
Oh, yeah. Well, exactly. And if I have to go into court and spend 6 years trying to enforce a contract, it's all over anyway. I've lost my interest. But I just want to tell you a quick story and share this with your readers about... A customer called me this week, and he wanted to know the price of maple leaves and American Eagles. And while we were talking, I said, well, you know, you can get a lot more gold if you buy Austrian hundreds or Mexican 50 pesos. I said, oh, really, can you? I said, yeah. So he got the prices, and he said, well, I'm going to check somewhere else, and I'll call you back. And so he called me back, and he ordered 30 Mexican 50 pesos, which is, you know, $34,000, something like that. And he said, you know, I want to ask you a question, though. After he did the order, he said, I want to ask you a question. I said, what? He said, well, I called XYZ, and they were $20 a coin cheaper than you on these American Eagles and Mexican and Maple Leafs. I said, oh, really? And then it occurred to me, he had called me back and ordered the Max 50s. Why was that? Because he realized that even though they were cheaper on these other things, that the advice that I had given him to buy the X50s put about two more ounces, another ounce of gold in his pocket.
Right.
You see, this is the kind of relation that you have to have with people. You know, you have to be willing to pay for, and it's not much that you're paying for it, but you have to have people that you can trust who will do the best thing for you, not just the lowest price and not just all the other things that they claim. They've got to be people who have your interest at heart.
Well, they've got to be able to perform in the worst case.
Right.
And that's not easy to do in this environment. Well, the other thing I wanted to introduce was you and I have now launched our revised version of the silver and gold payment calculator. And this is something I am so proud of. Because, you know, and part of it is just the, you know, dealing with the software issues of getting it revised. We put it up a couple years ago. And if you could describe, Franklin, the theory behind this, why it came into being, because this is really your invention, and I think it's brilliant.
Well, it gives them an instantaneous way to figure out what the value of any amount of paper money is in silver or gold, or both. And what it does is enable us to do business with each other in silver and gold instead of having to use paper money.
Well, one of the things you told me, you said, you wouldn't believe it, but it's so, what people just don't have is a calculator. You know, we're all used to exchange calculators to go from francs to dollars or dollars to pounds or, you know, so we're used to the idea of an exchange calculator for other currencies, but we're not used to an exchange calculator for a non-fiat currency.
Right, exactly.
And you know, it was the first, what the first one would do, and if you go to silver and goldormoney.com, you can play with it. Many of you have probably used it or looked at it. I keep it up all day because it's where I'm looking at the spot price. And what you do is you'll see the spot price for gold or silver, and you can put in an amount of money, any amount of money you choose. On the first calculator, we just had the dollar, and one of the changes is we've added a provision that will allow you to choose many of the top currencies, the largest currencies around the world. So you can do yen, you can do Swiss francs, you can do the pound, you can do the Canadian dollar. This is quite a reasonable selection. And you can see the prices. If you change the currency, you can see the spot price quoted in those currencies. We've got a feed from Gold Money. And so if you just want to watch the spot price and the spot price in a variety of currencies, there it is. The second thing is Franklin has created a list of coins. If you click on equivalents, you can go to a list of coins, and you can see in gold and silver sort of all the bullion coins that you might reasonably be expected to invest in. And you can also see their melt value. If you could explain, Franklin, what melt value is.
Well, that's just the gold or silver content of the coin multiplied by the spot gold or silver price. So it disregards any premium or discount that the item might have in the market, and it what it does is follow what the trend of the market is going to be, which is to premium always declines over time because an ounce of gold is an ounce of gold, an ounce of silver is an ounce of silver, and there's no reason that one ounce ought to have a premium over another ounce. And you know, the thing that excites me about this idea is it gives us a way to completely avoid using paper money. And it doesn't matter if everybody in the neighborhood is doing it or everybody in our community. If two of us are doing it together, that's enough because we've solved our problem.
Well, I first wanted to use it. When you first told me about it, I said, this is a brilliant idea because I kept giving as presents to the kids that I love, my cousins who live near me and other kids. I kept giving them gold and silver. I'm trying to interest them in gold and silver. And I kept trying to work out, well, how much should I give them and what should I give them? And I want to make sure I give Susie what I gave to Johnny and not more and not less. And suddenly I realized, oh, my God, this calculator is going to make my life so much easier, number one. And number two, I can use the equivalence chart to value my own portfolio quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can use this tool for a variety of functions. And if I can use it for these functions down the road, I ought to be able to get people, you know, we could start, if we needed to, we could start transacting in gold and silver.
Right, exactly.
It's
the answer to monetary chaos.
Right. And so if we really do get a meltdown or the slow burn turns really ugly and evil, or if we can't transact without our national biometric card, which I won't have, you know, how are we going to transact? And so to me, the calculator gives you a way, and the wonderful thing is what we're hoping sometime in the next month is to launch an iPhone app.
Mm.
So when you go look at the silver and gold payment calculator at silverandgoldormoney.com, what you're seeing is the website. A version of that is going to come out as an iPhone app. So for those of you who who use those little devices. Our great David Lichty at Soleri Silver and Gold. If you call Soleri Silver and Gold, you're going to get David Lichty, a wonderful attorney who's leading the launch. And, you know, you've seen him. He lives on his iPhone. So for the folks who live on their iPhone, the iPhone app will be there. But realize, you know, in a community, if all the merchants have either a computer or iPhone and all the customers have an iPhone, which I, you know, I'm ambivalent about, but, you know, you've got the calculator.
But the biggest hurdle to doing business with each other in a stable currency is overcome.
Yes.
Right there, period. I know that I'm not cheating you. You know that you're not cheating me. We're both getting full value for whatever our goods or services are. And suddenly what we've done is restored justice to the transactions that take place between us.
Right. And I should mention the last calculator, the new calculator has a feature that will allow you to put in a premium. So let's say you don't want to, you and everybody that you're transacting with says, well, you know, we want to envision a 2% premium, you know, because coins right now trade at a premium to the melt value.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do that, fine. You decide what premium you want, you put it in. You know, just make sure that it's not a one-way premium. But the new calculator and the iPhone app have the possibility of doing a premium. If you look, Franklin, at what it takes to start a community currency, because I've studied many community currency systems, and it's very time-consuming. You've got to get together. You create a team or an organization or committee or governance structure, and there's, you know, documents and rules and discussion and this and that. I mean, it's very complex. And the thing I love about this is you don't need an organization. You don't need rules. You just need to do it.
Don't have to petition Washington, don't have to change any laws, don't have to abolish the Federal Reserve, don't have to do any of that stuff. I just do it with my neighbor.
Right.
Period.
Now, if you could explain the constitutional background on why this is all perfectly constitutional.
And perfectly legal. The Constitution made a rule. You have to understand there was a huge chaos, monetary chaos in the United States, because each one of the colonies printed its own money, and they all traded at different values, and they depreciated at different rates, and it was just chaos, so there was no commerce across state lines. So one of the main reasons that the Potomac Convention was called, which became the Constitutional Convention, was that because of that monetary chaos. And so there were two things that came out of the Constitution. The first was states were forbidden to make anything except gold and silver a tender in payment of debt. And the second thing was that that the government settled on the federal government was going to declare what a dollar was, and they were given the authority to do that. Well, in 1792, in the first Congress, they actually did that, and they said, okay, a dollar is a silver coin that has 371 and a quarter grains of fine silver. And that's the standard coin of the United States. And then they established gold coins that were related to that in their value. So that was all set up, and that's still part of the law. That's never been abolished. The content of the gold coins has been changed a little bit, but that was to adapt to the world market. And all of this is perfectly legal. I mean, these are legal tender coins. You can do that.
Can we say that part of the Constitutional Convention was one of the most important 10 dates in the history of gold and silver?
Oh, I don't have any question of that, yeah.
Okay,
It certainly was, because what it meant was, and George Washington reports this in a letter he wrote shortly after the new Constitution had taken effect, that all of a sudden commerce reappeared. People started doing business with each other again. And it was like within 2 years, prosperity burst out everywhere. And that was the reason, because the uncertainty of all of those different paper monies had been removed. So that was certainly, you know, that in the history of the United States, and you have to go back until like 1675 when paper money first appeared in the colonies. Paper money had created all of this confusion for over 100 years, and suddenly that was removed, and what happened was that there was a huge blossoming of the United States economy.
Well, imagine if we all felt that we could trust the system, the trading system.
Hey, if you could just feel like you could save and know that a week from now your savings were going to be worth at least what you put into it.
We have, before we close, we have a question from a wonderful subscriber. I was wondering if you could read it and just respond to it.
Yes. She writes that she doesn't exactly understand because she had bought silver when the price was about $18, and she says, what if it is below or close to the price that she paid for it in 2008? And
that's when she if she
swaps now, right.
Well, now, just to explain, that's a gold-silver ratio swap.
Right. And the main thing you have to understand about a gold-silver ratio swap is we don't care a bit what the dollar price is for gold or for silver. The only thing we care about is what is the price of silver in terms of gold. In other words, how many ounces of silver does it take to buy an ounce of gold? That's the only thing we care about. So if she bought when it was 65, when it took 65 ounces to buy an ounce of gold, and now we can do a swap when it's 47 ounces of silver to buy an ounce of gold, well, she's just that much better off. You know, I mean, she's,
right.
18 points better off, which is 36%. So that's the first thing to realize is we're not thinking about this in terms of silver and gold. The swaps, dollars per ounce. That just doesn't have anything to do.
The way you see it is if you simulate over a 10-year period,
mm-hmm.
What you do, how you come out at the end if you swap back and forth versus if you don't,
mm-hmm.
and if you simulate that out, you'll be able to describe mathematically the phenomena you just described, because you're getting more ounces of gold than you would have had.
Well, I've been through the entire cycle with a number of customers, and they have gained from 50 to 75% in ounces.
Right.
So I don't have to explain this to them anymore. They understand that, yes, it does work. But she also asked another question. She says, you say that after we swap silver for gold, usually in a few months we have the opportunity to swap gold back into silver. My concern is silver is so volatile that I will end up holding it for a very long time before I can cash it in. Well, my answer to that is that's not a concern at all, because if we are correct that silver outperforms gold over the long term, what difference does it make what you hold? If you're holding the metal that's going to have the higher return, even
right.
though it does have more up and down to it, who cares?
Right.
You know, you're not going to be worse off. For instance, you know, in 2008 it looked a lot like we were wrong because the silver went down more than gold did, but then it also came back much faster than gold did after that bottom. So that's what we can count on. I mean, that's the reason that this works, is that the silver is a much smaller market and therefore much more volatile. And so a given amount of money going into the silver market versus going into the gold market makes that silver market rise a lot faster.
Well, it wasn't intuitively obvious to me when you first started to explain it to me. I had to go through it a couple times and then simulate the numbers, and now it makes total sense. Anyway, so take the time and go through it. There's a wonderful Soleri report we did in your archives called Trading the Gold-Silver Ratio. It was the Precious Metals Report,
mm-hmm.
and it's in the Precious Metal Report Library, and I recommend it to everybody if you haven't heard it. Well, Franklin, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
It's always a pleasure. It's amazing what you can do if you just leave and stay out there for 10 years. You can build a whole world. And, but I point out that you're someone who's invested in your children. And it's certainly, you know, they're certainly a pretty wonderful bunch. So let me just mention another question we got from a wonderful subscriber was a question about chemtrails. I'm going to do a series on chemtrails. We're starting next week, the unanswered questions on chemtrails. I'm going to try and do for chemtrails what I did for mind control, which is to give you an overview, frame the issues. There's plenty of uncertainty, and so we're really talking about how do we organize the uncertainty, how do we organize the questions that we have. Very wonderfully, the following week, Catherine Albrecht, author of Spy Chips, really the leading expert on the side of freedom for the on the RFID chip and the use of this kind of technology to control, whether it's, you know, putting it in the clothes we buy, putting it in our cars, or as I described with the National Medical Device Registry and the new healthcare bill, putting it in us. And so Catherine Albrecht on the April 22nd, it's a great lineup. So I look forward to talking with you next week. And just remember, don't worry about if there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you definitely need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.